Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Kitice. This week, the podcast is by Rabbi Daniel Landes, and in fact, Rabbi Landes will be speaking across the United States this autumn. Saturday, September 8th in the evening, he'll be discussing the emergence of Jewish time at Congregation Beth Shalom in San Francisco. Sunday, September 9th, also in the evening, he'll be presenting The Conversation, The Power of Jewish Narrative in Los Angeles at Kickstart Limud LA. Sunday, October 14th, Rabbi Landes will be speaking on the ferocity of Jewish intellectual debate, which is also part of the Exploring the Wisdom of the Talmud series, and that will be in San Francisco at Congregation Emmanuel. Friday, October 26th, and Shabbat, October 27th, Rabbi Daniel Landes will be the scholar-in-residence at Congregation Beth Israel in Berkeley, California. On Sunday, November 4th, in the late afternoon, Rabbi Landes will be concluding at Session 3 of Exploring the Wisdom of the Talmud in San Francisco. He'll be speaking on the search for Jewish identity. All the reservation and contact information about the rabbi's presentations is available on the podcast website, podcasts.pardesusa.org. Rabbi Landes is the director of the Pardes Institute for Jewish Studies, and he's speaking now on Kitice. And now, Rabbi Daniel Landes.
Thank you. This week's parsha is a killer, in more than one ways. Kitice is the name of the parsha when you go out. Kitice l'nuchama alayvecha. V'netanou adonai alahecha biyadecha. V'shavita shivyo. When you go out to war, just a punch in the stomach against your enemy, and God will place him in your hand, feeling good, and you'll take a captive, and from there all sorts of problems take place, because taking captive is not a simple thing. And war is extraordinarily messy, even when it goes in your favor. But if you think that's a punch, a relief at the same time, because you are being victorious, look at the first Rashi, our great commentator. Kitetze l'nochama, when you go out to battle, b'nochemet harashuta katuv b'daber. The verse is speaking about an optional war, reshut, a war that's within your own domain, meaning it's within your own control. I won't explain that. Shemelchemet Eretz Yisrael, but a war that's different, a war about Israel, and I'll explain what that type of war is. You don't say v'shavita shivyo, you don't say take a captive. Sherei kevar ne'amar lo tichya kol neshama. Because we've already said before in the past week's parsha, don't leave anyone alive. There's two types of war in Jewish tradition, or Jewish just war theory. The Catholics have just war theory. The Jewish equivalent to just war theory. There's Milchemet Reshut, and there is Milchemet Chova. There is the optional war, Reshut, within your own domain. And that's a war that's supposedly discussed here. That's a war in which it's done on the basis of benefit to the country. It's done on the basis of widening borders, straightening out borders, making sure that there's tranquility, making sure that there is enough space that the people can live. That's a difficult concept in modernity. And we know from the Mishnah, the rabbinic teaching, 200 CE, in the Tractate of Sanhedrin, Ein motzi l'milchemet reshut, you don't go out to this milchemet reshut, to this optional war, LLP Beit Shalshim Echad, unless you have the agreement of the court of 71, you're really supposed to have also the agreement of the Urim Batumim, this kind of oracular device that the priests had, but we don't have that in the Second Temple. But at the very least, you need these incredible legislative consultants. You can't declare war and on your own, according to the king can't do this on his own, according to rabbinic teachings. In fact, you can't do this kind of dodge that has been done in many countries, in which you don't declare war, but it's a war. You really need to have the agreement. Because a Milchemet Reshut, an optional war, is always very, very difficult and morally problematic. And are you making the right decision? Will it really lead to benefits? Is it actually something which is stained by immorality? And how stained it is by immorality? And even if you run the war right, as it were, there's still going to be problems. And is it worth that? That's called Milchemet Reshut. And the rabbis, and I would say the Torah itself, I think the rabbis reflect the Torah. The Torah is a little disturbed by Milchemet Reshut. It might be a necessity many times. Necessity is a funny term, but I guess it's not really a necessity. How can you call it necessity when it's called an optional war? It's an option that seems very necessary, but it's an optional war. Therefore, we're careful about it. And also in these optional war, all sorts of people don't have to enter into the fray. In Deuteronomy 20, we've already said that a person who has built a new house and has not entered it and has not dedicated it, and a person who has created a vineyard but has not yet benefited from it, a person who has gotten engaged but has not yet taken his wife, all these cases, go back to your home and take care of those things, and you can enter a different optional war at a different point. Don't worry, there will be more optional wars. A reluctance on this whole issue. But we're talking about today, by implication, in the Rashi, what I want to speak about today is that one that's really hard to talk about, and that's Milchemet Mitzvah. That's the obligatory war. That's the no-choice war. That's the war declared by the king. We'll look at Maimonides and see how he describes it. And we'll go back to see what that Rashi had said. And for this, we look at the end of Maimonides' great codex, the Mishneh Torah, in Hilchot Melachim, Laws of Kings. Right there, towards the end of this enormous work, chapter 5. And you know, the last chapter only has 10 chapters. And let's read it carefully. Maimonides writes, I'll read it in Hebrew, we'll translate it in his beautiful Hebrew. A king only does battle first, meaning that he takes the charge, he takes the lead, when it's an obligatory war. What do you mean by obligatory war? Maimonides asks. Well, he gives us three options. This is either the battle of the seven kingdoms, in other words, going into the land of Israel and chasing out the Chiti, the Girgashi, the Amori, the Kanani, the Prizi, the Chivi, the Yavusi, chasing them out, or doing battle to the end. That's one possibility. Umelchemet Amalek, or the battle with Amalek, the ancestral enemy of the Jewish people, what we know later on from the Haman concerns, Umelchemet Amalek. The Ezrat Yisrael Miyad Tsar Shabalehem, and the salvation or the saving or the help of Israel from though that enemy that comes upon them. These are the three conditions: conquering the land initially, the battle against Amalek, and the help of Israel, or helping Israel against the enemy that comes upon them. And after that, he can discuss whether or not there should be a Milchemet Reshut, that optional war. And since we're here, we'll continue to discuss how he categorized it. And that's the war that is fought with other nations in order to expand the border of Israel, in order to increase its greatness and its effect. I spoke before that Milchemet Reshut needs permission. And the Rambam repeats this. Melchemet mitzvah, eino tzirich litov bo reshut, the obligatory war, don't ask for permission. Eino tzirich litov bo reshut beit din, you don't ask permission from beit din. El yotzei me'atzmo, the king goes out. B'choet, at any moment, the kofeh ha'om, let's say, and he forces the people to go out. But Melchemet reshut, this war for enlarging borders, this war for straining out borders, these messy wars, these high intensity but then low impact or high impact and low intensity wars, all that range. And then let's see on by LLP Beitin Shoshim Echad, you only can go out with 71 learned people counseling you. Let's try to understand Melchemet Mitzvah and why Melchemet Mitzvah, or Melchemet Chovah, sometimes it's referred to. Why it's our obligatory war, war of mitzvah, its impact. Well, we know about the Shivat Amamim. We know about the first seven nations. We know about the fact that Israel was brought into the land. This was its destiny. And that's in the past. And we know about Melchemet Amalek. We know about the battle against Amalek, according to the rabbis, Amalek no longer exists. Amalek was a specific people who have been mixed in with all the rest of the nations. We do not know of any Amalek. We do not have a specific Amalek. And therefore, since we do not have a specific Amalek, that Milchama does not exist. But we'll come back to that category, because there's something left in that category. But the third category is the saving of Israel from the enemy that comes upon it. And the saving of Israel against whoever comes upon it is actually what we're talking about today. The papers are filled with worry, angst, speculation, and the worry and angst are even from those who favor it, about an attack on Iran. And this is a kind of a category which is not a category for those who discuss it as an optional war. It's not the category of kind of straightening out problems and border problems, etc. It's not kind of like what do we do in Sinai, or even what we do on the in Yudah and Shomron, the West Bank, whatever you want to call it. It's not like that. That kind of straightening out, as difficult and as hard and as bloody as that is. This is a whole other category. This is a category that talks about the salvation of the Jewish people, according to those who say we're totally endangered. Here we have an enemy who proclaims that they see the future as the Jewish people being wiped out, Israel being wiped out, Israel gone. And as we all know, they have, at great cost, both financially, great costs internationally, have pursued this goal of attaining the nuclear means to affect that cause. Do we always know for sure? Are we always convinced? Well, that's the argument on the other side. What we do know is that they soon will have the means. What we do know is that they have not wavered from this proclamation. What we do know is that there doesn't seem to be any major force within their country that opposes it. It may be passive. It may not favor it, but we don't know of any. No one's ever heard of a protest on the street. No one's ever heard of a imam getting up and saying, no, we can't go in this direction. This seems to be, and we have our history, and we have our memories that aren't far off, that are only at the most two generations off. We know what this means. Here, in fact, halacha and Zionism comes together. Halacha says it's up to the king. Zionism says that a leader must make a decision. And those few words of Maimonides, which chill me to the bone, in which he discusses, is that it's the king's decision And a king is only a term. It doesn't mean the king from David. It doesn't mean a king that wasn't from the kingdom of David, but another Israelite king. It just means the leader of the Jewish people. That's the effect. He must make that decision. And what does he do? Yotzei me'atzmo. I'm repeating the words. He goes out on his own without asking permission. Becholet, at any moment, which means at the moment that it needs to be done. Vekofeh ha'am, let's say, and he forces the people to come out after him. Of course, this Melchemet Mitzvah, Melchemet Chovah, obligation to save the Jewish people, is based on a decision. It's based on a decision that if we don't do this, we will be wiped out. The Rambam commentators make no distinction between a genocidal policy or extermination policy, I'm sorry for using contemporary terms, a mass murder policy, to use an older term, that's in progress, and one that's about to happen. We have a general principle. Someone's coming to kill you. Do not wait till they're killing you. Rise up and kill them first. But the impact here is so enormous that it's almost impossible for us to consider it. The impact of how many will die on our side. There was one speculation by Ehud Barak, 500. No one knows where he got this number. Is this an acceptable number? Most people would say it probably is. How can a Jew say it's an acceptable number? But no one believes that it's only 500. Everyone knows what it means that what Iran has presently and what Hezbollah has. But it may be, quote-unquote, worth it. That's a very hard decision to make. And for how long? For a year? For 2 years? For 3 years of delay? In terms of where this country will be and how they'll come back with great force? Nonetheless, there may be no other choice. Here I feel very humble in terms of what Judaism brings to all this. Something I think Judaism itself is humble. It realizes that these decisions are of incredible magnitude and incredibly difficult. I feel the humility that the entire religious infrastructure on the right of center religiously, who in the sense of taking themselves out of the working of the Jewish state, have nothing to offer in terms of wisdom on this. And I feel very humble that actually even those who are involved very much with the state right now, referring to the religious Zionists, have so focused on the Milchemet Reshut, on this kind of optional war about what the borders should look like at Sinai, what the borders should look like in the territories, Yudan, Shomron. I don't care about the terminology, but they can't think now. It's hard for anyone to think straight about the overall goal. The magnitude means the following. And we go back to that Rashi that I said before. The Rashi says that this parsha cannot be talking about taking captives, because we saw before that in the previous parsha, last week, lo tichya kol neshama, that in such a case of a b'chemet mitzvah, a mitzvah of defense, a mitzvah in which we're defending our very lives, don't allow anyone to leave. Live. Don't allow anyone to live. It puts us in the place of creating massive, massive, massive destruction as the only way of defending ourselves. Yes, there will be some consideration about not doing damage where damage does not need to be done, but the damage nonetheless will be of incredible proportion. So this is where our enemies have placed us. They have placed us in a position that we need to make faithful decisions on behalf of our people. I would say also on behalf of the world. The tyranny of Iran would be unbelievable for the rest of this region and for the rest of the larger super region, and has impact elsewhere. At a time when we have precious few friends, and sometimes the friends are reluctant despite all sorts of political intrigue, but they're reluctant. We have to make a decision. And that's why I also want to go back to this one other concept of the war that I said no longer exists, and it's Milchemet Amalek, the battle against Amalek. Amalek, the rabbis wanted to get rid of this idea. They were no longer comfortable with the idea that Amalek exists. Amalek is Murab, Murbav. Amalek is mixed up with all this ancestral enemy. It's mixed up with everyone else. So Amalek as Amalek, even within its cities of Shushan and Tehran, no longer really exists from halakhic point of view. Or is that really not true? Two major commentators, one of them, the Rabbi Brisk, thought long and hard on this in the 1800s, and he says that Amalek is not just a specific people with a specific gene pool. Amalek is one who has the bacillus of hatred, one who defines themselves in terms of destruction of Israel, destruction of the Jewish people. That is Amalek. And we should never forget that Amalek can exist. Now, we've never evoked this. And even after World War II, we never evoked this. We never had the power, but we also didn't want to evoke this. And even just mentioning it now sounds awful. But if you think straight and hard about those who want to destroy us, about those who have no compunctions, those who bring the benefits of a long culture and of a long religious history and of great minds, but bring it to bear in terms of pointing towards our end, we need to ask ourselves, is this a Milchemet Mitzvah? Will this save us? And if it does, then we must do it. Is this a battle against Amalek, that the people who are against us are truly against us? I wish you Shabbat Shalom. I really hope that this Dvar Torah, this Shabbat, will be seen in future times as silly and as foolish and imaginative, and we never had that problem. Came to hear Ratzon that this should be a foolish Dvar Torah, pre-Yom Kippur, Purim Torah, but we need to think, and we need to think hard nonetheless.
Thank you, Rabbi Landes. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.